The latest research on the pace and scope of climate change and sea level rise from the director of the UMaine Climate Change Institute. Paul Majewski has been leading expeditions to study ice sheets in places like Antarctica and the Himalayan Mountains for four decades. He has published his pioneering research in two books and more than 350 scientific publications. Majewski was one of the first scientists to document the rapid changes in ice sheets. And by studying the chemical composition of ice cores, he has been able to look at how the atmosphere has changed over history and how those changes have disrupted civilization. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Professor Majewski shares with us some of the latest research out of the UMaine Climate Change Institute and from around the world. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Climate science is changing rapidly. It is hard to keep up with the latest information. Never mind, make sense of it all. Today, we're going to get some help from one of the world's foremost experts in the field. Dr. Paul Majewski is with me today. He is professor at the University of Maine and the director of UMaine's Climate Change Institute. And as always, we want to hear from you. What puzzles you about climate research? What questions do you have about the latest climate science? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dr. Majewski, thanks so much for being back with us on Maine Calling.
Thank you for the invitation.
This is the first time you've been on the program since the death of your colleague, Gordon Hamilton, and I know that you'd been on so many expeditions with him and you worked very closely together. I was wondering if there's anything you'd like to say about Gordon or his legacy before we move on to the science.
Well, Gordon, his tragic death was an immense loss, obviously, to his family, but also to the Institute, the university, and he was a very important member of the scientific community. He was working on the issue of sea level rise and how much we'll experience. And he'd done some remarkable work. He was only 50 years old, so he unfortunately had a long career ahead of him, and there would have been a lot more exciting things that we would have learned. But he has a great group of students out there who are going to carry on his legacy.
All right. Well, let's turn to the research. You know, you're a glaciologist, but you head this institute, the UMaine Climate Change Institute, which is interdisciplinary. Can you describe to us how your team works together to analyze the science from different fields? Do you take a question and have different people go at that answer to that question from different angles?
I wish I could say we were that organized. being a director of an institute like this, where we have a lot of very accomplished people, it's a little bit like herding cats. We are interested in the same sorts of problems. We have sort of things that we know we want to understand, obviously the climate system. We tend to come at it from different directions, but we meet regularly. We write papers and we write proposals together, so there are plenty of opportunities for us to share information. The great thing about the Institute is because it's so multidisciplinary, we really get to think about things in different ways and from different perspectives. And we become even broader. We're now beginning to engage compute, not just physical, chemical, biological, and social scientists, but computer scientists, people from business, people from law. Climate change is a rapidly expanding field of great significance.
I can think of one obvious way because I've had the pleasure of being up in your freezer where you keep the ice cores.
Right.
And I know that you, as a scientist, can say at this point in history, this was happening in the atmosphere. I can look at the chemistry. But then you can go to your colleagues who are studying anthropology or studying history and say, what was going on in the world? What was going on in civilization right now as this happened? And you've had some really interesting findings because of that.
We have. And it's been very exciting. The latest project we've worked on is with Harvard History Department, Mike McCormick there. And it's been remarkable to compare an ice core that we've gotten from Europe with written records from that overlap exactly the same time. And so we can count back year by year, nowadays literally storm by storm, and see what people were writing about at that time. Now, that's not just of academic interest. It provides us with examples, analogs of how people respond to climate, of why, in fact, history in some cases took the course that it did because of starvation, because of droughts, a variety of things, volcanic events, which tended to obviously change the climate for a couple of years. And it's important for us to understand what underpins the way we live and our climate. One of the most recent examples is probably the drought, which had a tremendous impact on Arab Spring.
Explain that.
Well, because of the drought, obviously in the Middle East, many of the people who for clearly centuries had only been farmers, I shouldn't say only farmers, farmers are terribly important, but had were farmers, but they were not in a position ever to do anything other than farm. And of course, once drought hits, water is our most important commodity, far more important than oil. There was nothing that they could do with their farms. That left them open to all sorts of other ideas, positive and negative. And there are many people who believe that a significant underpinning of the Arab Spring, in fact, was that drought event. And we can go back in history and see major droughts, the collapse of the Mesopotamian Empire 4,200 years ago, this amazingly well-developed empire in modern-day Iraq. Suddenly, precipitation didn't get there for a matter of a few years, and bang, the entire city was done. You can't have a city if you don't have water.
Of course, we're having this conversation as Maine is technically in a drought, but other parts of the United States are in a very severe drought. Is it too facile to link that with the kind of climate change that you're looking at when you study glaciers?
Not at all. That's exactly what we want to do. We do this work and go back in time because the recorded record, the modern recorded record of climate really only goes back 50, in some cases 100 years, and it doesn't capture the full behavior of the climate system. So you want to understand how much can climate change, how fast can climate change, where does it change, when it does change, what happens. And with these ice core records, we can go back and do that. In the early 1990s, a large program that I led in Greenland, we discovered and verified what was called abrupt climate change, or what we call abrupt climate change. Until then, we all in the climate community thought that the climate system operated very, very slowly. That's a very important paradigm because it means that if the climate system operates slowly, you can do anything to it. It'll be hundreds, maybe thousands of years. We realize that the climate system can change even naturally in less than a year or two, very, very dramatically. If that's true, then as long as you have that trigger occurring, you can have a fast response. And that's what just happened in the Arctic. Throughout the 2000s, the Arctic experienced dramatic warming. In particular, from 2007 on, there have been parts of the Arctic that have increased on an annual basis within about 5 years, 9 degrees Fahrenheit. That's immense, immense. Mm. It's the equivalent of doubling the length of the summer in the Arctic. And that has not only had immense ramifications for the people who live in the Arctic, their lives have changed completely. It would be the same as probably making our winter twice as long as it is right now. In fact, that wouldn't even be as dramatic. But the other important thing for us and the rest of the Northern Hemisphere is that it has actually changed the atmospheric circulation patterns, the distribution of moisture, storms throughout much of the Northern Hemisphere, including Maine.
Mm. I remember interviewing Gordon, and he talked about 1 year having gone for several years to the same site, landing the helicopter at the mm-hmm. same site, and then 1 year it was gone, not being able to find it. It had just vanished. And that's the kind of thing you're finding year after year, isn't it?
Absolutely. We do. Most recently, we've been doing a lot of work in the Andes. And there are literally, these glaciers are in very remote places. People don't get to them. Sometimes back after 10 years. And what was a glacier and a major water source for the local ecology and perhaps some local inhabitants, gone. The same thing is happening all around the world. And it's a very, very dramatic impact, not only locally because of water supply, but for many large regions that depend on the water for drinking, for electric power plants, for agriculture. It's a remarkable, remarkable difference. And those are all sort of mini abrupt climate change events. They're not as dramatic as the one we had in the Arctic. They're far smaller and not as big.
Mm. So there's really no way to exaggerate what's going on in the Arctic.
That's a good way of putting it. I like to say that, you know, the climate system has several things which make it change. And humans, we didn't create something new. All we did was take the way the climate system normally operates, and we pressed a couple of buttons like greenhouse gases and increased the rate of change 100 times more than it had been in the last million years. And once you do that, and the magnitude, but once you do that, you get a very, very fast response because the natural system is trying to react as fast as it can. And that's exactly what we've experienced in the Arctic.
Let me ask you this, because as you well know, many climate change skeptics say they look at your ice cores, they look at some of the historical data and say the climate has always been changing. How do we know? How do we really know that it's greenhouse gases that are accelerating it? Or would it be accelerated anyway?
They're absolutely right. The climate has always changed, and the idea of talking about climate change as only a modern event isn't correct. We've had climate change ever since the Earth had an atmosphere. That's by itself a very important point. That means that we need to continue to study climate change even if we weren't doing anything to it to understand what's going to happen in the next few years. How do we tell whether or not humans have had an impact? If you measure greenhouse gases, toxic metals, changes in temperature, changes in wind patterns, you see that things have happened very, very fast in the last few decades, and they're extremely anomalous compared to the way we understand the natural system to operate. There's a lot of variability in the natural system, but we've gone well outside the range of variability in the way climate changes and in its response. The last time the Arctic warmed as fast as it did in the last few years was most likely close to 12,000 years ago when the last big remnants of the ice sheet that covered North America started to melt back. It was a doubling of the summer at that time. That covered a much larger area than the warming we just experienced, but that's the magnitude. So at least 12,000 years and potentially hundreds of thousands of years.
Let me ask you about sea level rise. My understanding is that in the last century, we've seen about 6 inches on the main coast. Is that correct?
Something close to that, yes.
What do we expect now in the next century?
That's a very good question. If you go to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this is a group of 100-plus countries that get together, people from a lot of different disciplines, and they sort of agree on what I like to call the least common denominator of science. It is a phenomenal foundation document, but it tends to be very conservative because it has so many different players involved and so many different agendas, and I'm not even talking about science. There's a lot of political interaction, policy interaction, economic interaction, and that thing. They all suggest in their last document that sea level by 2100 would be between 25 centimeters and 1 meter, so up to about 3 feet. Now, that is significantly more conservative than they said 5 years before that. And if you take a look at the geological record, the last time the temperature was 2 degrees centigrade, that's about 3 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer than it is right now, was about 120,000 years ago, and at that time, sea level rose anywhere between about 2 and 5 meters. So the bottom line is, if we even experience the smallest warming that is expected by 2100, we will, within the next 50, 100, maybe 200 years, experience sea level rise, which is going to be 2 to 3 meters, if not much, much more. So that's 6 to 9 feet. That's very, very big. So why am I talking about 100 or 200 years from now? Should anybody care about sea level 100 or 200 years ago? Yeah, we should actually, because if we're going to prepare for the situation today, we need to think about infrastructures that are going to last many, many decades. So sea level is an immediate problem for the small South Pacific islands. It's an immediate problem for Southeast United States, which is so close to sea level. we probably have decades more in places like the coast of Maine before we begin to feel as dramatic impacts as certainly the South Pacific Islands, but it will happen. There are, however, even more immediate things that are going on. With warming, we've seen a tremendous migration of vector-borne diseases, for example, Lyme tick. We've seen an increase in the frequency of heating events. In 2003, close to 50,000 people died in Europe in the summer because of heat stroke. We live in a state which obviously has older people, and very, very few of us have air conditioning. We're just not used to a lot of rapid frequent heating events. And the expectation is that they will increase quite dramatically in the next few years. So we're experiencing different storms than we did before. We're going from one winter, as we did 2 years ago, when the eastern United States was locked in cold and the western United States was dry, to the next winter when it was much, much milder until January, February, which sort of looks like what's going to happen this year. These tremendous differences in the length of the seasons, the magnitudes of the seasons, all have to do with the wind patterns that deliver moisture, that deliver heat throughout the planet. We all know when the wind blows from the south, it tends to be warmer. And those wind patterns are being severely impacted by the loss of ice and the warming of the Arctic.
There's been a lot of discussion about this idea of a tipping point.
Mm-hmm.
And some people believe we've passed it. Some people believe we aren't there yet. What is your belief? And actually, why don't I step back and have you explain what's meant by that, the tipping point?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think the idea of a tipping point is a great soundbite. It's sort of like global warming was a great soundbite, but it doesn't it gives you the necessary feeling of immediacy. Yeah, I mean, that we could get to a point where something very, very big happens, like an abrupt climate change event that happened in the Arctic. My belief about tipping points is there isn't one tipping point. We already hit one. If you live in the Arctic, you hit the tipping point. Your life changed. Everything's completely different. And those of us who live downwind from that, downstream from that, we're beginning to feel some of the effects. There will be other tipping points. One of them arguably already happened in the Middle East with the increase in drought and in North Africa, the drought that started certainly in the 70s and has increased. So there are probably tipping points around the world, and those are responses to increase in greenhouse gases, changes in ozone levels in the upper atmosphere that we've all created. So is there one tipping point? In a way, you could say that. You could say that once you get past a certain greenhouse gas level, you absolutely know that you will in the coming decades experience a certain rather dramatic amount of heating. But I think a more helpful way of thinking of tipping points is to think of them as being more localized. And when the tipping point comes to us, we will know it. We've had a small tipping point with Lyme tick disease. Our lives have changed. The way we function in Maine is quite different because of the migration of Lyme tick. Is it as big as Arctic warming? No, not necessarily, but to many individuals, it's an important tipping point.
Some people use the phrase in a sort of fatalistic way. We're already there. Why even try to change now?
That's certainly one attitude. And I guess if you believe that, then you just sort of forget about everything and you let things continue. But that's not the way the climate system or the world ought to work. And that's obviously not the way humans have been as creative and as productive as they have over history. To assume that it's just plain too late isn't correct, in my opinion. Number one, yes, we have bought into a certain amount of change that will absolutely happen. The fact by 2100, if not much, much sooner, we will experience globally at least a 2 degree centigrade rise in temperature, if not much more. And in some regions, it'll be much greater, as it is in the Arctic. But to take that fatalistic view and assume that it's about to happen doesn't make much sense. We obviously want to decrease as much as will happen, and that is within our capability. We want to adapt to it, which is critically important. So mitigation is one, adaptation is the other. But then we need to learn not just how to live with these things, but we need to learn how to create a better situation. We've done a lot of damage to our environment. We've been a lot smarter in the last few years about not allowing that to happen, to repair it. But we need to get smarter. We need to be more efficient in the way we use things. Who wants to spend thousands of dollars a year on heating oil when, in fact, there are more efficient ways of delivering that heating oil through your house? Or there are other mechanisms like renewable energy. So I think, particularly for younger people, there are great opportunities. There are going to be some very unpleasant and terrifying things that happen. Right now, we have 65 million refugees in the world, as I understand, and about 1.5 million of them have migrated to Europe. The expectation for climate change as it progresses in the next few decades is at least that many people, if not over 100 million people. So we need to understand not just how we adapt where we live, but how those changes will impact us, how they impact those people. We need to, as people said in the 1970s, we need to think globally and act locally. It's the smartest thing we can do to protect ourselves and to protect everybody else.
My guest today, Dr. Paul Majewski at the University of Maine Climate Change Institute. We do have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Dirigo Pines in Orono, offering a spectrum of retirement living options on a 68-acre wooded campus, dirigopines.com. Today is Giving Tuesday, a global day of giving, encouraging philanthropy and celebrating generosity worldwide. Giving Tuesday harnesses the collective power of individuals, communities, and organizations to encourage philanthropy and to celebrate generosity worldwide. Giving Tuesday is held annually on the Tuesday after Thanksgiving and Black Friday and Cyber Monday to kick off the holiday giving season and inspire people to collaborate in improving their local communities and to give back in impactful ways to the charities and causes they support. We ask you to join the Giving Tuesday movement and help promote our efforts. Whether you choose to give, become a personal fundraiser, or share our media posts, help us build a stronger community. And if you'd like to support Maine Public Radio or television, please visit mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Climate Change. With me in the studio, University of Maine Professor Dr. Paul Andrew Majewski, Director of UMaine's Climate Change Institute. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Maine Calling Facebook page. We'll start with Christina, who is calling from Bangor. Hi, Christina. Go ahead.
Hi there, Jennifer. Thank you. Yes, I'd like to invite Dr. Majewski and listeners in the Bangor area to attend a film on documentary on climate change called Facing the Surge, which will be tomorrow, November 30th, at 7 p.m. in Gracie Auditorium, Gracie Theater at Hudson University. The documentary will be followed by a panel discussion and is sponsored by Citizens Climate Lobby.
Christina, I invite you also to go on the Maine Calling Facebook page and post information about that for those who may be listening without a pen in their hand.
Good idea, Jennifer. Thank you very much.
We're going to move on. We'll go to Vinyl Haven and Chris. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hello. Hello. I have three questions for the doctor. Sir, you mentioned earlier of the melting glaciers, and I understand that with the melting of the glaciers, they are finding evidence of civilization in the ice. What does this evidence indicate for our times? The second question to you is, what caused the warming 12,000 years ago that you spoke of? And how much funding is the U.S. Government putting forth for this climate change research? Thank you in advance.
Well, thank you very much for your questions. As far as melting glaciers uncovering past civilizations, there are certainly places in alpine regions, Europe, the Andes, the Himalayas, where archaeological finds that were unknown before are getting uncovered. And that means, obviously, that the glaciers were not there at that time. There have been mild periods in the natural climate record hundreds of years ago, in some cases thousands of years ago. These were obviously not caused by human activity, and we're beginning to see the glaciers that are melting provide us with this archaeological information. Now, you might think to yourself, well, if the glaciers melted in the past, then why do we think that glacier melting today is such a different thing? Well, not all glaciers necessarily melted at the same time in the past. We're seeing massive melting throughout large parts of the alpine regions. Plus, we know from our records, and I don't mean just my records, but many scientists, that levels of greenhouse gases, which are directly related to heat trapping on the surface of the Earth, are significantly higher than they have been for probably a million years, and increased in rate about 100 times faster than they ever have before. We're just seeing the very initial stages. So that means we're going to go through things that might have occurred in the past, but we are right on the edge of beginning to see things that are extremely unique with respect to hundreds of thousands of years. So your next question, why did the ice sheets melt, the large ice sheets over both hemispheres? In the case of the Northern Hemisphere, they covered much of Arctic Canada, parts of Europe, and certainly extended down through Maine. They changed partially as a result of greenhouse gas rise, partially as a result of where the Earth sort of drifted with respect to the sun. The closer the Earth gets to the sun in its orbit, in its tilt, it changes the amount of radiation that comes in. And then there are an awful lot of feedbacks. The climate system really wants to constantly try to equilibrate itself. So if you give it any sort of a trigger like a rise in greenhouse gases, a change in the amount of radiation that comes from the sun, change in the frequency of volcanic activity, a variety of things, you get a response. Clearly, the Earth system, because of where the Earth was with respect to the sun, was on its way towards warmer climates, and it eventually there was a sharper trigger around 12,000 years ago. And then funding for climate change. Of course, I do get my funding from the federal government and from other foundations. The amount of funding that goes into research in general in this country is certainly a significant amount, but it's a tiny amount proportionally compared to an awful lot of other places. And it's a tiny amount when you compare it to an awful lot of other things that the government spends its money on. So you ask, one asks oneself, is it worth spending this sort of money on research, and in particular in climate change? And I would answer that for climate change, if we could figure out whether, you know, I believe that humans have done a tremendous amount to change the climate system, but even if the climate system is turning natural, or is changing naturally, it's critically important to know what's going to happen in the next few years. It will determine where agriculture is practiced and a variety of other things. So climate change research, yes, we get funded, and the funding is very, very important to us. And if anything, I think because of the fact that this next century will be defined to a large degree by how the climate changes and where we will see climate refugees emerging and how we all change our lives, it's important to keep that funding going.
Chris, thanks for your call. We'll move on to Walderboro and Rick. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about what do you conceive as being the worst case, worst possible conceivable scenario in terms of sea level rise in Maine in the short term, in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years?
That's a great question. I think in the short term, we should probably be much more concerned about storm surges, similar to Hurricane Sandy. That's a sort of a one-off event that occurs because of obviously, storm patterns. Low-lying regions are always at risk of storm surge. The frequency of storm surges is probably increasing, and the magnitude is probably increasing simply because atmospheric circulation systems are being changed in their pattern largely because of Arctic warming. So I see storm surges as being the most important thing for us to think about along the coast of Maine. Over the next few decades, we will certainly experience a rise in sea level. And those areas that are very, very flat surrounding the coast akin to the regions that we have that exist in Florida and the Carolinas. Those will be the places, of course, where the effects will be the most dramatic. Much of coastal Maine, however, is better protected by rocks. We have an awful lot inlets in which this water can be redistributed. It's not that it's a non-problem at all. It's a very important problem, but the short-term problem over the next few years is clearly storm surge and a gradually rising sea level.
So there are really two issues here. One, high tide might be a few inches higher at a place like Old Orchard Beach,
right. But
then also there are going to be more storm surges, and then the volume of water that comes, even an inch more of water, is a lot more volume of water coming at, Maine's coastal towns and cities.
Absolutely. It would be the very best approach would be for people who live in coastal communities to think very carefully about their vulnerabilities. Are wells too close to salt water? Are roads too low? The roads that flood once every 5 years, maybe you would expect that those roads, because they're so close to the ocean, would flood far more frequently than that. And so communities need to think about the places and the situations that make them vulnerable and then begin to prepare from that point of view.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Majewski, head of UMaine's Climate Change Institute. Thank you, Rick, for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Moving to Larry in Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead. Larry, we can barely hear you. Can you speak up or come closer to your phone?
How's that?
Much better.
I certainly agree with you 100% that the perturbations weather are going to be the major problem for people you're in my age. My former professor, physics professor, and I have a constant argument about climate change. He's feeling that solar quiescence is going to overrule the solar changes due to carbon dioxide and methane. And I'm wondering, is there any paper that compares the two? I've not been able to find one.
Yes, there certainly is. If we lived in a world in which we weren't changing greenhouse gases, in which we weren't impacting ozone in the upper atmosphere, changes in solar energy input would play a much bigger role in our year-to-year climate. In fact, 20, 30 years ago, if you wanted to predict how the climate would operate, you could almost look at the solar cycle, and it is a very big help. That's not the case anymore, number one. It isn't to say that the solar cycle isn't important, but it plays a very, very small role, and it doesn't necessarily play a simple role in terms of heating the planet. And the reason that we know that the solar cycle is not capable, or changes in energy coming from the sun are not capable of producing the changes that we see right now is because of satellites that have over the last 30 years been able to measure incoming solar radiation outside of our atmosphere. When you're down at ground level, you could make the case that a lot has happened to that radiation. It's a little bit harder to interpret it. But when you're making those observations from above our atmosphere, you realize that the changes are very, very small, and they could never accomplish what we have experienced throughout much of the Northern Hemisphere, and certainly not what we've seen in the Arctic.
Thanks for your call, Larry. You mentioned satellite images, and I'm wondering if with the explosion of ways of looking at climate science and the technology between the satellites and the computational know-how we have now, if, in your view, there have been any big surprises in the last couple of years, things you didn't expect to see that you are seeing now?
Well, the satellite imagery is phenomenal. In fact, Gordon Hamilton was our primary person in the Institute who looked at satellite imagery. We are seeing changes not just in glacier extent, but as just appeared in the news, places along the coast of Antarctica or the coast of Greenland, where you have large masses of ice that have floated off these interior ice sheets and are getting close to the ocean, we're now seeing large cracks that didn't appear before that are telling us that these massive sheets of ice that have floated out onto the water are potentially going to just break off. Now, this is a natural process, but not at the rate and the extent that it has been for the last 10 or 20 years. We would have never known about this. Those of us who work in Antarctica know that the likelihood of there are so few people. There are a place that's 1.5 times the size of the United States like Antarctica. I doubt seriously that there are 500 people walking around on that ice sheet during the summer season. I've spent more than 40 years working in the Antarctic. I've never bumped into anybody in the middle of the Antarctic ice sheet. So how would we ever observe these things without satellites?
All right. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We have to have one more break. When we come back, more with our conversation with Dr. Paul Majewski of the University of Maine.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does International Paper, hosting a job fair tomorrow and Thursday at the Comfort Inn in Wilton from 10 a.m. until 8 p.m. Positions are located across the U.S. and require 5 or more years of experience in engineering, maintenance, and/or environmental health and safety.
Hello, I'm Linda Hunt. Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Danish architect Bjarke Ingels. Known for his controversial and innovative designs, Bjarke Ingels' many projects are reshaping the New York City skyline. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
And you can hear that City Arts and Lectures program tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. Join us today at 2 o'clock for Speaking in Maine. We'll head to North Haven Island for a panel discussion on aging on islands, how aging has changed in our country and should change. That's Speaking in Maine coming up after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program Climate Change Research. With me in the studio, Dr. Paul Majewski. He's the director of UMaine's Climate Change Institute. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Here's an email from Matt. He writes, "My understanding is that the CO2 in our atmosphere is not going away anytime soon and that global warming won't reverse itself. Is there any viable way to actively cool the planet, such as by releasing fine dust into the atmosphere to reflect some of the sun's heat? What is the state of the science around active climate control?"
That's a great question, too. I think one of the terms that's used is geoengineering. So can we make this problem go away by geoengineering it? My personal belief is that we should be doing as much research as we can. However, the likelihood that we will absolutely find something is probably less likely. We've already run an experiment without trying when we emitted a tremendous amount of sulfur and nitrogen into the atmosphere as of about the 1940s until the Clean Air Act in the 1970s. And the impact of that was potentially to offset greenhouse gas rise for a while. But of course, the downside was that we destroyed tremendous amounts of forests and a variety of other things. So by putting sulfur in the atmosphere, for example, a whole series of volcanic events, we would get a cooling, but we don't necessarily like the result. By putting a lot of small particles in the atmosphere, we already have a lot of small particles in the atmosphere. It would affect our air quality, air traffic, a variety of things. People have suggested throwing tons of iron into the ocean in order to make the ocean more productive, and it would increase CO2 uptake. But it turns out that that's not so trivial, and you have to dump a lot of iron. And by the time you transport it back and forth, you probably have emitted as much CO2. People have talked about large mirrors in the upper atmosphere or outside of the atmosphere. That would be obviously pretty tricky. Whether or not you could be that effective is not clear. The smartest thing for us to do is obviously to find ways to conserve and become more efficient.
We'll go to Portland and Willie. Hi, Willie. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Thank you very much for the program. My question relates to the idea of the Greenland ice melting affecting the Gulf Stream, and I'm wondering whether you could describe that dynamic and give us an idea whether there's a potential there to stop the Gulf Stream with increased and rapid Greenland ice melt. And I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Thank you for the question. There's certainly evidence in the past that if you introduce large amounts of fresh water, as would occur if you melted the Greenland ice sheet, and in fact, it's occurring right now, that you could change the strength of the Gulf Stream. So it's happened in the past. The Gulf Stream is certainly a mechanism by which heat is transported from North America over to Europe. It's a very important heat delivery system. But there's also a tremendous amount of heat, probably twice as much heat, that's actually transferred not just by the ocean but also by the atmosphere. So my guess is – not my guess, hopefully my educated guess is that the shifts in atmospheric circulation patterns, you know, the changes in the westerlies, these big embayments that we're seeing, that we saw a couple of years ago when we hit cold air over eastern North America, these are far more effective in actually transporting heat around, particularly the North Atlantic. Does that mean that the Gulf Stream is not important? No, not at all. It's an important part of the system. And if we add enough fresh water, we will change its heat transport capability. But it's not just a stream. Think of it as a bunch of as a series of eddies throughout the North Atlantic. And whether or not those eddies would actually how effective they could be in changing circulation rather than just adding a lot of cold fresh water to a channel or a stream is, of course, the big question.
Thanks for your question. We're going to move on to Heidi calling from Southern Maine. Hi, Heidi. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm concerned. I would like to first find out about the – I have two questions. One is, what are the cultures that you've been studying? How are they affected by what you've been discovering, for one? And two, is there a need to put together or a calling to put together a global fund for those on the front lines of climate change? Most people think of those on the front lines as people who have – and those ravaged by those – by the fossil fuel industry, like the people in Alberta, Canada, fighting the tar – who are dealing with toxins from the tar sands. And
– okay, and wondering if you
– Standing Rock, but also I'm wondering about the people in New York City and Miami and Portland.
Sure, sure. Go ahead, Dr. Majewski.
Well, as far as cultures, I could answer that in two ways. One would be past cultures, and there's clearly well-documented evidence for very fast changes in climate that led to, as I think I mentioned earlier, the collapse of major civilizations, the Mesopotamian Empire in modern-day Iraq and Syria, but also the Mayan Empire was in Central America was greatly impacted by changes in precipitation patterns. For modern cultures, wow, absolutely yes. In the Arctic, the people who live in the Arctic, their culture has been irrevocably changed. If you go to, for example, more populated areas, one that I'm very familiar with, a place like Chile, Santiago, Chile, has half the population of Chile in it. It gets its water and its hydropower from melting glaciers that are depleting regularly. And the population of Santiago is going up, and the water availability is going down. And this is not the only place on Earth where it's happening. As far as a global fund goes, yes, there will be many, many people impacted. I think those of us who live in Maine, despite the fact that we are seeing vector-borne diseases like Lyme tick, changes in heat frequency, we're really on the very lucky end of the spectrum. We will, although we're in a drought right now in general over any particular decade, we probably will have very reasonable amounts of water. We'll have milder summers, perhaps longer growing seasons. We will have a lot of in-migration from people, other people in the United States. So we're on the lucky end. If you live in parts of Africa, parts of Asia, South America, there will be immense impacts in terms of drought, even if you live in the western United States, obviously.
Thanks, Heidi. We're going to go to John in Montville. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
I read somewhere recently that a climate change denier stating that one volcano can create more carbon in the air than all the trucks and cars exhaust in over 1,000 years. Now, Can you talk about what's the magnitude of a volcano as far as putting carbon in the air? I know it sounds like a ridiculous claim, so I'd like to hear something about it.
It is a very interesting claim. If that were the case, we would have had plenty of examples in the not too distant past. For example, the Pinatubo eruption in 1992, we would have seen a giant spike. That isn't to say that there aren't emissions that are related to volcanic activity, greenhouse gases, sulfur aerosols that aren't important. But those effects are very, very short-lived, at best a year or two. The biggest volcanic eruption that we've had in the last 100,000 years, which we were fortunate enough to be able to study in our ice cores, was called the Toba volcanic eruption. And the impact of that eruption was to put enough sulfur into the atmosphere that it literally cooled the climate for perhaps 100 years. So if anything, volcanoes are not going to warm the climate. They're going to cool the climate.
Thank you for your call, John. We have an email from Robert. There are probably many people listening right now who believe, he has the word believe in quotes, that climate scientists like you are unduly influenced by government funding and grants, which they would lose if they do not support the consensus that climate change is a severe problem. What would you like to say to them? Is it possible to persuade them that the scientific process is objective?
That's a good question. And you certainly have to wonder about people's agenda and why they do what they do. I can only speak personally about that. I started in this field a little over 40 years ago. For the first 20 years, I probably would have had to pay people to give a talk about climate change. That's how much interest there was. And there wasn't necessarily a lot of money for this kind of research. But over that 20 years, and certainly in the most recent 20 years, it has become absolutely apparent from at least in the things that I've done, and I've spent a lot of time in remote areas all over the world with glaciers, which are very responsive to climate. It has become undeniably clear that we're seeing these changes. And once, as a scientist, you begin to see evidence mounting up, you begin to change perhaps what you were even taught when you were in school, and you begin to develop more and more information. And that information today is overwhelming. And as I mentioned earlier, I think this is one of our biggest security issues that we face. That's not in any way to trivialize other security issues. But this will have tremendous geopolitical, tremendous health impacts, tremendous impact on the frequency of extreme events, and tremendous impacts on our economy.
When you say these impacts, are we talking about in our lifetime?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because as I was finishing that sentence, I clearly led people to believe that I was using the word will. I shouldn't use the word will. You're absolutely right, Jennifer. These changes are already happening in various parts of the world. So you can literally go to almost any place on Earth and find at least some impact of the climate change that has been occurring in the last few decades, some far more extreme. Again, I go back to the Arctic, but it's impacting every single part of the world. And it is part and parcel of the way, in fact, the environment is changing. The climate is just part of the environment. We have changed where we the distribution of forests. We've changed where we develop food from and how we do. And all of these things have really changed our quality of life. So there's no doubt at all that we are already feeling many of the impacts, some places less than others. But the places where those impacts are being felt, again, like the Arctic, there is no debate.
Yet I know that you are hopeful, and I want to end with that. Why, Dr. Majewski, are you hopeful?
I'm very hopeful, despite the fact that a lot of what I said might sound depressing. I'm very hopeful because if we understand the fact that there is a problem, and if we are able, and I'm not saying the climate scientists will be able to absolutely predict how climate will change every single year in every part of the world. But if we begin to understand better and better what those changes will be, we can prepare ourselves and we can create, and I use this word very carefully, opportunities. A lot of places there won't be opportunities, but for the younger generation, they can begin to think about how they can actually make a big change. If, for example, you could learn, and it's already being demonstrated, or I shouldn't say learn, but teach people how to grow crops in regions that have been inundated by rising sea level, therefore more salt, you have made an immense contribution to humanity. And that sort of thing is happening more and more, and there are more and more opportunities to do that.
Well, thank you, Dr. Paul Andrew Majewski, professor at UMaine and the director of UMaine's Climate Change Institute. John Keimel ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. This show will rebroadcast tonight at 8. Tomorrow on the program, our Month in Review program. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.